Are you blessed or are you cursed with a strong imagination and a spiritual thirst? Do you wanna confide about the darkness inside? Come and talk about it on Self-Worst.
Hey, you there. Hi, welcome to Self-Worst Podcast. I'm Brad Pearson, the host and your friend, your best friend. What's going on? Hope you're having a good week. It's pretty much spring. I know we just had a big, or you just had a big snowstorm in the Midwest. That sucks. That's why I don't really live in the Midwest anymore. but hey, come on, it's spring. What are we doing here with the late snow and the wind and the, all that? The battle's won. It's already been St. Patrick's Day. It's going to be Easter. It's a good time of year. It's fun. It's nice. Yesterday was leg day, and I did what I always do on leg day, and I overdid it. Did too many squats, too many lunges, fucked up my legs, and I still gotta walk around for my job for the rest of the day. And I have to kind of waddle around. I got this, like, stiffened C-3PO walk, like I'm trying to keep a pencil between my butt cheeks. Sucks. Can't go downstairs. I have to, like, kind of just sort of lean out over the stairs and just let my legs involuntarily catch me. Because my legs, I can't actually do the dipping part. Always overdo it. I fucking hate leg day. Leg day sucks. Everybody hates leg day. I feel like that's sort of like the vegetables. You know, eating your vegetables in the weight world, weight training, the lifting world. Nobody likes it. Everybody likes training their upper body because it's fun. Because you like getting big arms and big chest. Legs, it's just necessary. You gotta do it though. You gotta eat your veggies. You got to. It's a responsibility and it's part of the whole thing. And sometimes you gotta do some shit that you don't want to do. Oh, speaking of lifting, did you see Love Lies Bleeding yet? Oh my god. Go see that shit. That movie rips. That lady is so ripped. Wasn't it Katie O'Brien? Yeah, she's amazing. She's so fucking scary. She's so great. Oh, K-Stu. Goes without saying K-Stu's great. Love an evil Ed Harris. It's just fun. It's just go see it. You're gonna like it. It made my whole week. Anyway. Doing our taxes this week. I don't like that at all. I do not like being confronted with how little money I make and how bad I am at all this adulthood stuff and paperwork and just being a guy. That's pretty embarrassing. How I still feel like I'm 21. Like, you know, trying to, like, figure all this stuff out. It just sucks. I don't know. It's been a week of that. It's been a week of just doing stuff, facing stuff that I don't quite want to do. Had an unpleasant conversation with a friendly acquaintance. Had to get into it about some shit. What are you going to do? You could, I mean, this was over text, and like my usual move is to just not respond and just kind of pretend it didn't happen. That's a very Midwestern conflict strategy that I'm trying to move away from. Trying to just follow through and resolve conflict and just try and work with people and not, you know, because the thing is, like, in person, when it comes out of nowhere, I feel like I get all hot in the face and then I fly off and say something I don't mean. But if it's over text or DM or comment wars or whatever, I feel like you have more time to kind of hash things out, think about it, respond instead of reacting. But the other thing you can do is just do it later and just keep on doing it later. And just never get back to the thing that was bothering you about what they said or what they did, you know. but you gotta do it. That's your homework for this week, folks. Squash a beef. Resolve a thing. Anything you've been putting off. Yeah, any kind of unpleasant thing. Even if it is, you know, just doing your taxes. Or if it just, you know, just digging something up with somebody and just be like, hey, that bothered me, or hey, and just work through it with them. And if they can't work through it, then maybe they kind of suck. And maybe the friendship, the relationship wasn't so good anyway. Or maybe you suck. Ever think about that? That's entirely possible. You might have to do some apologizing. You owe anybody an apology? Did you fuck up? You gotta come clean about some shit? Well, then do it. That's what you gotta do this week. And you know what? If you apologize, they don't necessarily have to accept your apology. But if they don't, then you have to fight them to the death. Because that's the only way to maintain honor for you and your house. So I hope it goes well for you. Look, this week, we're talking to a New York comedian, Freddie G. I heard him on a couple other shows, recently thought he was cool, and wanted to invite him on. And we talk about a lot of this stuff. We talk about conflict, controversy, anger, having differences with people who you are close to. And what do you do? Do you hide? Do you bury your head in the sand? Do you act like a little bitch? Or do you get out there and do the thing you don't want to do? Well, you're gonna find out what he does, and you'll find out. I won't spoil it for you. Listen to the thing. Anyway, that's all for the intro. Let's go to the interview, and let's go to the interview.
Oh, okay.
We'll just kind of get into it slowly, you know, because I like to kind of feel out where my guest is at with how quick they want to, you know, get into stuff and open up about things and whatever, you know.
I'm an open book. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I'm doing well. Yeah, life's been better this year. Yeah, last year my dad died in July.
Oof.
Then. Yeah, my dad died, and then just since the Israel war started,
yeah,
I lost the job. I had a rough last 6 months of the year, and then after New Year's, I just have felt a lot better.
That's good. Okay. Were you close with your dad? Are you close with your family now, in general?
I was when we would talk, I was close. Like, we cared a lot about each other. We didn't get along great. He was a Trump supporter. He was crazy. All these things, yeah.
So. Wow. So you're kind of no stranger to having some, you know, controversy with and some disagreement with people who you're close to.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we disagree. Yeah, I'm cool with that, yeah.
You're cool with kind of the discomfort.
I'm okay disagreeing and meeting people where they are, you know, to an extent. Then sometimes it's too much.
Right. Because not everybody has that. Like, that can be a really difficult thing to manage, especially like to the degree, you know, or what it is you're disagreeing about. You know, if it's something about a minor political issue versus like issues of is this person a human or not, you know, like that gets to be like a bit more like, I don't know if I can really like agree to disagree on this one, you know?
Oh, at some point. Yeah. It stops. Yeah. There's mm-hmm. things that are too far. Yeah. There's a, like I initially right after the Gaza war, whatever you call it, started. I'm an anti-Zionist. It's just horrible. Initially, I tried to meet the Zionists halfway, and there's no meeting them halfway. They get angry at you. They're not. They're just shooting talking points at you, sending you propaganda. And by now, it's like, well, you were mad at me for calling it a genocide in October. It's like since December, January, it's basically been proven a genocide. Like, it's just too like. Where's my apology? How about, you know, if you're still covering for it, what are you covering for now? I don't know anymore. Yeah. I lost respect for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's rough. I don't know. It's you've mentioned before that you've lost some friends and you've you know, family members that, like, people who, like, you don't really talk to much anymore.
I kind of had friends who were like family that I lost. Because I'm not that close to that much of my family, and my family doesn't really care.
Right.
There's two kinds of, basically, in like the late 1800s, and I'll always go into history and stuff, but yeah, there was two kinds. There were Jews who went to Israel, to Palestine and became Zionists and started Israel eventually. And then there's my family where people just came to America from Europe.
Right.
And then we really don't have that much of a connection. Now, a lot of other Jews moved to Israel since then, but none who happen to be in my family. People in my friends' families, I guess. And that does make them more connected to it.
Did you go on Birthright?
I did go on Birthright.
How did you feel at the time? And, you know, how did it change? How did you come around to sort of realizing that it was, in fact, a birth wrong?
So, yeah, I went to a Zionist school for 9 years, like a day school. That's where a lot of my lifelong friends are from. Or then also you meet people through them later on. So, so I had come from that background. I didn't go to Israel when I was younger because I was scared. And then I went on Birthright when I was 21. And it was just, it was not, I mean, it's such a nice land. And then all the Jewish stuff they made us do, I didn't really like. And the trip, I mean, the trip, you don't see much. You're just in an apartheid state, and this was in 05, so it was slightly different, but there was already, they were building the security fences in the full apartheid. I'm sure they already had a lot of checkpoints and stuff, but yeah, you didn't see the Palestinian part of it. When you're around Zionists, there's really no talk of Palestinians. Now, they did have, like, they had, IDF soldiers on the bus and that kind of stuff, which I realized later was propaganda.
You kind of left Judaism first before you kind of came around to speaking out against Zionism, and that people took more of an issue with the Zionist part than the, like, I'm no longer a practicing Jew part.
Yeah, secular Jews are very accepted. The original Zionists were actually pretty secular.
Mm-hmm.
So secular Jews are very accepted. I mean, when I was in the conservative day school, they would make fun of people who ate non-kosher. They'd be like, the rabbi, I remember, was like, your Uncle Harry who eats pork. And I literally had an Uncle Harry who ate pork. So I felt very, like, guilty about that.
Right.
So there's that. So I felt the judgment there. But then, you know, I became an atheist when I was 19, and just stopped doing any of it. And then people kind of accept that, even Jews who are conservative or modern Orthodox. Because ultimately, your observance doesn't really affect them, and they can easily make friends who are observant like they are. You have to go to the ultra-Orthodox, where they start caring that you're secular,
right,
is what I found. But the conservative and the modern Orthodox are very strongly Zionists. And even if people don't talk about it a lot, there are people in their family who are very Zionist.
What was it when you were 19 that brought you over to the dark side, that made you an atheist?
I have a joke about it where I just say, like, I hadn't yet gotten laid, so I was like, there is no God, and I've been an atheist ever since. I think I was just sad, and I was just like, I don't believe in this anymore. And then once I kind of crossed that, then nothing ever pulled me back in. I think just the only reason I believed in it is because I was in the school and I figured that's what's right, so I should move towards that.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I didn't think it was right, you know, and I've been questioning for years, I was just like, okay, I don't believe in this. And it's very freeing.
Yeah.
The ability to kind of believe anything based on what you actually see and learn is very empowering. Also religion is kind of the opposite of creativity, I think. You're spending every day, you're supposed to go and say the same words at the temple, and then you're supposed to read the same things that were written a long time ago, and there's really, maybe you're making some legal creativity where you can kind of like interpret things, but that's where it stops, kind of. There's a real limit. There's such a reverence for the past that there's never there's a limit to how creative you can be. I'm not saying you can't be creative separate from that, but at least that life, I think, does constrain creativity.
Your parents, you mentioned, are fairly laid back when it comes to Judaism and the practice thereof, and they sent you to this day school without kind of realizing how orthodox it was. Is that correct?
Yeah, and it was conservative. So there's three levels. Reform is the chill Jews. They go to temple, but it's in English, and you can kind of do whatever you want. Mm-hmm. Conservative is like, we don't follow all the rules. We follow the ones that are practical to follow, but we're extremely judgy about it. Then Orthodox is they follow all the rules. And ultra-Orthodox is they follow rules that aren't even real. And they basically just turn there. It's not also one group. Also, this is just a bunch of smaller cults,
right?
That follow their own rules and think that each other's wrong. So an ultra-Orthodox, not some of them are actually very anti-Zionist, and some are very Zionist because they're not uniform in the way conservative and modern Orthodox could be a lot more uniformly behind Zionism than ultra-Orthodox. Ultra-Orthodox is just not uniform at all.
Yeah, this was something that kind of came as a surprise to me, that a lot of like Hasids in Brooklyn are actually anti-Zionist because the idea of the state of Israel is like, well, no, we're building an Israel here. We're here and now, and this is our place. And you know,
yeah.
I think that's sort of the idea.
The problem is, if you want to wear those big hats, those hats are not indigenous to Israel. Those hats are from Poland.
Mm.
It's you cannot wear those hats in a hot climate. You will die. So they need to be in a hat friendly environment because the hat's a big part of their thing.
I don't even know how they do it in the summer here, man. It's crazy.
Oh yeah, it's insane.
Sweltering. They look miserable.
That's why they built those tunnels, because they can't go outside in the summer. They needed the tunnels to stay cool.
My parents, so I was raised Unitarian, and my parents, when I was a kid, sent me on accident to a Christian daycare, thinking that it was just held in a church. They were just like, oh yeah, because we'd been to ones before that were like just held in a church, but it was like the YMCA or something. It was fairly secular.
Yeah, yeah.
It didn't really matter. And this one was just like, oh, okay. They seem to be a little more like church based, but it'll probably be fine. And I don't think it's really like crazy, but lo and behold, I was told that me and my family are going to hell and all this shit. And it was, you know, I was like maybe in kindergarten, first grade, or something.
What type
like
of Christianity
that.
Was it? I'm kind of obsessed with Christianity, so I've read a lot about it recently. So what type?
I don't even remember. probably some sort of like evangelical or Baptist kind of like pretty conservative Christian kind of thing. It was in Nebraska, so
the evangelical. Okay, that makes sense. The evangelicals, the majority of Zionists in America are evangelical because they're a bigger group.
Yeah,
and they're a lot of the push behind all this stuff.
Well, and that's what gets really creepy is when you talk about like Christian Zionists and like the reasoning behind like why they want all of the Jews to go to Israel because they want like to start the rapture and for all of the Jews to die in the rapture so they can start over in the second coming and all this like insane biblical revelation shit that's just like, oh, okay, this is you know, like creepy. It's extremely creepy.
There's basically a game of chicken with the Messiah. The Christians want the Jews in Israel so their Messiah can come, who will then kill us or kill two-thirds of us, whatever. And the Jews, the ultra-Orthodox Jews who are anti-Zionist, think that the Messiah has to come before we go to Israel, so it's our Messiah. So there's a bit of a game of chicken going on. Messiah, it's called Messiah chicken. Yeah, it's a big division in American views on Zionism.
Who you got your money on?
The evangelicals seem to be winning. So yeah. If their God is governing things, they are kind of conquering the earth, the evangelicals.
So obviously this is a very big, important issue to you. I mean, you're wearing a watermelon t-shirt right now, and this has been, you're very forward about this stuff, and this is very like,
it's changed my life.
It's like really been like at the forefront of your mind. It seems like it's you talk about it a lot. Has this been like, are you normally concerned usually with like social issues and history and wars and stuff, or is there something about this one in particular that really got you?
So this one is particularly something, but in general, I basically started getting into. So I was very into Hamilton. I was like a typical liberal into Hamilton in like 2016. I got into it in 2016, the soundtrack. Mm-hmm. Listened to it 300 times. And then that got me to start reading history books. And my mother-in-law got me into the audiobooks. So the first one I read was the Hamilton audiobook. And then I read so many history books, and I started reading, especially after George Floyd, ones not by old white men. It just made me more and more left. And then I just I became a leftist, and I started just caring a lot more about politics and history, and kind of wanting to dedicate, I don't know about everything I do, because like a lot of it's not that funny, but like a lot of what I work on towards that stuff.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, I don't know if you've ever listened to the Revolutions podcast. I forget the guy's name.
People have told me to.
Yeah. He starts off basically like as a sort of classical Western lib. And by the end of it, he's just like, well, I'm a leftist now because I've learned history and I see the patterns and it's opened my eyes to all of this. And now I'm a big lefty and I don't believe in capitalism anymore. You know?
So 2020 deprogrammed me from capitalism. Then 2021, I read books by this guy, David Graeber, who's like an anarchist.
Yeah.
He has a big history of debt. If people want to check him out, the book Bullshit Jobs is his most approachable book. It's about how 40% of people will admit their job has no value to society.
Mm-hmm.
So I started reading him, and he made me kind of more like a crazy leftist. Like a leftist, like, okay, I'm a leftist. You know, I stopped listening to Pod Save America, started listening to Pod Damn America.
Uh-huh.
And just became it. And at that point, I started tweeting a lot about it and started criticizing Biden, and I lost all the hardcore lib followers on Twitter. So I pushed them away. That is how you can kind of tell. Like, so I've already lost a lot of people with that. And then in 2020 also, right before the last Gaza war, which is 2021, I read 100 Year War on Palestine, and I was like, I can't pretend to be neutral about this anymore. I need to actually talk about this. And I talked about it a little. That war was only about a month. So I talked about it a little. I'm sure I put some people off. But, you know, then that war stopped and we went back to normal. Everyone kind of pretending that they get along. But then this one, it's just like some things are important. Like that's how COVID was. Like, oh, COVID's going to kill hundreds of thousands of people. This is important. This is a defining issue. We need to let it change us. And we need to talk about it and treat it like it's not normal. And then this war in Gaza, or this attack in Gaza, is the next one, because it's a genocide being done in the name of American Jews. And America is, America's responsible for it. They give Israel a veto in the UN. They provide the weapons, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And America is the only one who can stop it, because Netanyahu will never stop it, because when the war ends, he loses power due to corruption stuff or whatever.
Right.
And also allowing October 7th to happen. So their only stop of it is America, or at least America letting somebody else stop it. But by vetoing the resolutions in the UN, America is just enabling it.
So, I mean, yeah, as like for you in particular, it sounds like as a Jewish person in America, like this being carried out, like, you know, in your name is particularly fraught.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Because we got also it's just good to show that Jews aren't a monolith,
mm-hmm.
because then we'll seem bloodthirsty, because this thing's real bad.
Mm-hmm.
All Jews support denying food to 2 million people. Like, we wouldn't want people to think that, because that's real. That's like something like Genghis Khan would do. Like that, it's medieval.
Where do you think your sort of like moral compass developed? If like. You weren't necessarily super influenced by Judaism, or at least you kind of walked away from it in your adolescence. Then, like, now, where would you say, your sense of like no, I need to take a stand here, and you know, it doesn't matter if this is bad for my career, or my social life, or whatever. I have to start talking about this and not stop talking about this. What motivates you to do that?
Yes. Yeah, so, yeah, Judaism, like most religions, it's morality made by someone with extreme OCD. So maybe there's morality like don't kill, or there's be good to other people. But most of the time you're focusing just on like what you have to eat or not eat or whatever. So it's not like a real deep morality. It's very superficial. And frankly, I just find it very annoying. Observing religious rules, very annoying. But yeah, I think my morality got awoken. I did a meditation retreat in 2009 when I was about 25 that really changed my life. Mm. I did a Buddhist meditation retreat, didn't talk for 10 days, did a lot of meditating, and it made me like want to become a good person. So I was working in finance and just, you know, being brainwashed to be selfish and not care about people. I also happened to do it the year that my brain was finished fully forming. But that happens around 25. And that just made me want to be a good person. And then I was ready. Then I got to my wife. She's a good person. Told me to be even better. And I've been kind of on a journey to be good since then. I guess I also felt like I wasn't going to be silenced initially when I talked about it. And then they're not like, they have like zero tolerance for any of it. So if they already dislike you, the Zionists, you might as well just keep going for it.
Right.
You've already paid the penalty. And then also, I was talking about it initially like it was going to be for a week or two, because that's how these things usually are. I'm like, well, they can't deny food to people for more than a week or two. And then it just kept going, and it's like, well, it kept going. Like, we got to keep talking about it. So it's been like the intensity of like a week or two emergency for all these months because it just won't stop. And then I lost some people I really care about. And once you lost them, there's nobody I care about more who I'm going to lose. So just, you've already paid the penalty. Hmm. Once you've paid the penalty, you might as well keep doing it.
Right. Did the thought cross your mind, like maybe I should just shut up to keep these people in my life?
That's the thing is also, I never cut any Zionists out of my life. They cut me out, or they told me they don't want to talk to me, I would just mute people on social media or not really talk about it. And then I'm like, oh, we could sit down and talk about it and explain it. One guy at who I saw at a mic, he did a joke I didn't think was – I thought was a little too, I guess, anti-Zionist. And we actually had to talk about it. We ended up coming to an understanding. It was great. But the people who cut me off didn't really want to do that. Or they just want to message you properly. I would just say the Zionists cut me off. I didn't cut them off.
Hmm.
So then there's no choice. And then it's like, well, you've already suffered for this. You might as well keep going. Also, it's the right thing to do, and you can't abandon the Palestinians. The Palestinians really need us.
Right. So, changing gears a little bit, how long have you been a comedian?
So, I started doing it every day, but that's what makes you really a comedian, is doing it like as an everyday part of your life. Maybe you're not on stage every day, but you're putting that daily commitment in summer of 2014. So, I'm hitting 10 years of that.
What made you want to start?
I had a college TV show, and I liked doing. I thought I could be funny on camera, you know, talking whatever. I knew I could kind of get into that mode, and then I put it aside for a while, because there was no support, and I didn't really know what I was doing, and I was still becoming a man or whatever, mental health wise, whatever. So then I took a class in 2010. And I got when I did the class show, I got laughed not just from the people who knew me, but from like, you know, I'm not saying the entire room, but like a lot of other people. Mm. And that made me show me I could do it. And then summer of 2011, I'd been doing it off and on, doing improv. I was at the fireworks on a rooftop in Baltimore. And I looked at it and I was like, Fred, you don't need to like go to grad school or focus on finance or become a businessman or whatever. You can make comedy your career, and you can still keep doing a day job. And then since that moment, I've been serious about it. But like I said, it took me 3 years to get started doing it every day. New York's a very tough place to start.
How has the work-life balance been managed?
Oh, I got laid off 3 times. It's terrible, yeah.
Yeah.
I became a terrible worker right after that. I mean, there's ways to balance it. My third job, I was balancing it well, but the company got bought. Then I started just tutoring freelance, and that was going well. That was balancing. Then I had an agency that was great. Then on February 15th of last year, I found out my dad's cancer had spread, and initially I said I could teach a class the next day, and then late at night I said I couldn't, and they just didn't accept it very well. And then I did end up teaching it, but then they basically put me on the back burner. And then even after he died, I was kind of still with them, but like not really getting work. And then they told me on October 30th that I was fired. And it was it just brought back the morning so badly. Yeah. And it also, it's made my whole, like, I'm now struggling to find income. I was able to get unemployment. They said I wasn't fired, but I really was fired. I got unemployment, and it was just so cruel the way they handled it. It's been a balancing, and now also it might end up being a blessing in disguise. I'm really trying to make money on the road and money through comedy, but it's been that basically I was balancing it for the first 5 years after the third time getting laid off, but since what they did to me, it's been really tough.
Have you had bullshit jobs of your own?
Oh, they've all been. Depending on how you define it, right. Sometimes it's like you really have no work to do. That's clearly bullshit. I've had a lot of those. I had all the email jobs in finance. Some of the jobs I did earlier on were more intense and less bullshit. But then any job in finance he calls bullshit is you're just making rich people richer. There's that definition. Then like when I was, when you're tutoring is not a bullshit job. It feels really good. But if you're helping kids who just are rich and can afford it, well, I mean, that's good. You feel good helping them, but you're not really helping society because they already have a lot of advantages. And on standardized tests, they're forced into a bell curve. So by helping one student, you're hurting all the other ones a little bit.
Right. Right. So how has your mental health been? I mean, like, walk me through kind of your journey with it.
That's a long one, yeah.
Yeah. Any discoveries and tools you picked up along the way?
I mean, I went to therapy for 10 years. I'm on antidepressants. I've been on the same basic cocktail of antidepressants, anti-anxiety since 2005.
Why did you start that?
I mean, it's a long, yeah. I was a very shy kid. I was very nervous, phobic about a lot of stuff, afraid to talk to girls. When I was 9, I was so nervous. I was too anxious to eat. Different periods between age 5 and age 9. At 9, it got so bad that I would like worry about throwing up and then basically make myself throw up out of anxiety every day. Yeah.
Every
I still
day.
Can't watch the Yeah, I mean, for like a week. Like, wow. I mean, like for a week or two. I mean, then it got less freak, you know, then it right. got better. But at the peak, it was like, maybe it was, if it feels like it was every day for a week, I don't have, you know, that is a very long time ago. That's 31 years ago.
Right.
So yeah, like I can't watch Frasier because one time it was during the song Toss Salad and Scrambled Eggs. And then every time I hear that song, it makes me feel like I feel like a cringe of nausea. Even just talking about it, yeah. So that was when I was 9, that part. I went to child therapy. He told my dad, who's very got a lot of mental health stuff of his own, to like not make me so nervous about it, and then I got better with that. Then I was 17, had no date to the prom, and never talked to a girl, had very few friends in high school, was deeply depressed the year before. And I was just like, okay, I'll go to therapy. And then I went to therapy for like 10 years over the next 15 years, 15-year period, and improved a lot. And then got on antidepressants, like I said, the meditation retreat, growing up, working in finance got me very organized, like that kind of stuff. And just yeah. improved, but it's a long journey. Yeah, that could be. Yeah, that could probably be the whole pod. Yeah, it's a lot.
Yeah. What are some highlights? What are some snapshots from it that you think were particularly sort of sea change moments?
Let's see. Definitely, just like I got on the antidepressants, and I know people. A lot of people are like crazy depressed, and like they tried them, and they don't really help. There's some bad side effects for some people, and there's like the suicidal stuff. Also, just it's trial and error. But luckily, the first one I got on helped me. and helped me a lot. I felt basically like, are you familiar with the book Flowers for Algernon?
Yes.
It's also a movie called Charlie. Basically, it's about a special needs, you know, mental special needs guy. I'm blanking on the correct word right now, but who gets made into a genius. And I felt like that guy. Like I had just, I felt like my brain had been changed in that level of way. And yeah, that just, it was a big change. Like I could tell that it was the right way to be. That I'm supposed to be on these things.
You finally felt maybe like you could get out of your own way and just like be a person, do stuff in school,
yeah,
do
less
stuff
anxious. At
work and just like live your life.
Yeah, less anxious. And yeah, just basically there's like a self-hatred. There's like certain chemicals in your brain or combo of chemicals that'll happen periodically where like you go into self-hatred mode and it's hard to get out of it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's only for like a night or a day, and sometimes it's for months. And yeah, this so basically just I don't go into that mode to nearly the same degree. So like, yeah, like I felt really sad in the fall, but I was able to kind of, I knew it would pass.
Yeah.
In a way, yeah, things didn't, just basically there's, the chemicals are somewhere in my brain, I'm just ready to be very depressed and just full of self-hatred, and it doesn't easily end. So with the medicine, it doesn't really happen.
Yeah, I mean, situational sadness is a thing that is just an inevitable part of life, that in fact is not something that needs to or even should be fought off. You know, if something sad happens, if your dad dies, if you get laid off,
yeah,
it's right that you're upset and that you grieve and that you're sad for a while. You know, it's when it becomes, there's no apparent cause and it's out of nowhere and it's just relentless that it just sort of, then it's gotta be addressed. It's gotta be talked about, but having the, I guess, you know, just by living life, having the wisdom to sort of know the difference between the two, is huge.
Yeah, that is the thing. Yeah, it's that these things, like I started the antidepressants or consecutively around age 21. Then the meditation was around at like age 25. So like I kind of did these things that I give credit to around the time when your brain probably would mature anyway. So it is interesting. Yeah. To isolate and all. We only live one life. So yeah, it's not a perfect science experiment. But I just think the therapy was really helpful. Helped me get out there. Told me to join clubs. Listen to me. Helped me understand when I'm being crazy. Mm-hmm. It's also, this is all a long time ago. I quit therapy so here's what happened. Trump won in 2016.
Yeah.
And the next day, my second of the three jobs that laid me off told me I was getting laid off. And I still quit therapy that week because I just felt like I didn't need it anymore. And she agreed.
Wow.
But I was able to do it after like two crazy friggin' things. Yeah. So,
right.
Yeah. Because that is, yeah. There's, you know, there's just moments, yeah, that are, Trump winning now, it's like, well, we've had COVID and a million other things, but it's like, that was a big, crazy moment.
That was a big, crazy moment for a lot of people. I think it's maybe easy to forget or kind of minimize it now. Cause like you've said, like since then, so much shit has also piled on top of that. Since that, yeah. it feels kind of minute, or maybe we feel kind of, I don't know. I look back on that time and almost feel a little embarrassed for how affected I was by it, by how like upset I got, and you know, that it didn't merit the kind of like apocalyptic devastation that I was giving it in my head. You know, at the time it was weird and fucked up and like a strange, crazy thing. But like looking back on it, I'm like, I wish I had been there to kind of tell myself like, it's, you're going to be fine. You're going to be all right.
I think the big thing was that he was incompetent and lazy. Mm-hmm. That was the big thing. So he wasn't effective at being a fascist. He's down to do it, but he was incompetent. I don't know about in a second term if he'd be more competent, but I would say Trump winning in 2016 was The Wizard of Oz, a seeing that there's just some weird man behind the curtain of politics, that it's not competent people, that it could just be if it was a crazy, unqualified, terrible person, things would basically be run the same. And I think it just like it pulled away the allure of the whole thing of politics in America.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people believed up until then that the office of the presidency was this high, dignified, you know, sort of sacred thing.
Yeah,
and that
yeah.
this fucking buffoon getting in there was defiling it somehow. And again, it's walking through, you know, the moment as it's happening, walking, like living through history, but also looking back on history that you weren't there for. The more you read about it, the more you kind of understand that, like, nah, they've all been kind of like fucked up, corrupt dickheads, and there's been a lot of incompetence. There's been a lot of fucked up people. There's been a lot of, you know, like, it just like, if you really look at it, he's not that different than Reagan. He's not that different than Nixon, you know, and this is just sort of where we assigned all this, this grace and sacredness to something that doesn't really deserve it, which is
absolutely
just, you know,
and
a political
I understand,
office. Fuck them.
I get the people who are leftists then already knew all this stuff. I'm saying for me, though, mm-hmm. and I think for a lot of other people, there's other people who were at Occupy Wall Street in the early 2010s who, like, Obama did that for them because, or whatever. Like, oh, it could be a black guy and they're still going to, like, screw us all out of housing or whatever. Like, there's other people came to that realization later, but for me at least, yeah, it was pulling the curtain away, in that way. And yeah, now I've read about all the presidents, and I think they're all bad, and yeah, it's definitely something I want to work on, stuff about that.
What have been some of the, like, kind of tools that you've learned in therapy? Like, have you learned, like, did you do CBT? Did you do, like, mindfulness exercises or anything that have sort of come into your like daily toolbox?
So now for me, therapy is now something I stopped doing almost 8 years ago.
Right.
So like, I'm not like, oh, did the therapist give you ketamine? It's like, that wasn't even a thing anyone would think of. Like, that's ancient. Things change very quickly. So yeah, like same thing like dating. I haven't dated since 2010. So I've been my wife a long time. It's completely different now. Mm-hmm. Like things are changing quickly. So like, it was just talk therapy. And then like, when I said I want to go to the meditation place, she was supportive of that. It's really about therapists. You want to find someone who's a good therapist. It's not about the degrees. My two best therapists were just MSWs, Masters of Social Work.
Mm-hmm.
It's someone with the skills who's good at therapy. I'm not sure how you would tell that before you meet with them, but that's what you want, just a good therapist. It's not about their education level above a certain amount. They need to obviously be trained in therapy. Right. They should, you know, have some kind of education. Also, I don't think a master's of social work is that easy to get. I mean, you got to get a college degree and probably go to school for like 2 or 3 more years, whatever. So like, that's qualified enough that, yeah, like the PhDs and the ones who are MDs, like that's a whole other level of education that probably doesn't make them a better therapist.
It doesn't necessarily. Yeah. Because then you are just, you've just learned a lot of stuff about just the soft science of therapy and psychology, or the hard science of medicine, neither of which are necessarily applicable to a patient. And I think what matters more is it is kind of it's almost woo-woo and kind of intangible, you know. It's this sort of question of like, is your heart in it? Do you care about people? Do you connect with your patient? That's a lot harder to quantify, and it is just so kind of vibes based, I think, that you honestly don't even really know, I think, until you've like been with a particular therapist for like a minute, you know, and then you kind of understand like, I'm vibing with them. I feel like I can open up to them. I feel like I can, you know, be vulnerable, whatever, or I don't.
Yeah. I also, now I'm thinking about it, like, how old is therapy? People would say like Sigmund Freud or whatever. Basically just talking to someone and them kind of like listening to you and maybe giving you a little advice or helping you steer your thoughts. that's probably like thousands of years old. Just the very nuts and bolts of it, and like people being good at that. And like academia or like whatever, like doctors didn't invent that. Like that's probably a very ancient thing. And it's just someone who kind of ties back to that. And yeah, I lean like leftist anarchist. So like, yeah, the degrees on the wall is just some hierarchical BS to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's really about just the human connection, the human vibe. And that's a very like important thing that can get left out of the formal education. So like that said, how do you, Freddie G, vibe as a human? How do you get your vibe? You go out in nature, you connect with people. What are your go-tos?
How do I vibe as a human? I do like nature, like hiking. I think hiking's very good for you. It's good for your mental health, all that. How do I vibe as a human? I mean, I need alone time. I do think going on Twitter and just like kind of like writing random things down helps me. I've actually found I wasn't going to open mics that much after COVID, but going to open mics and just like talking to people and doing a set helps me kind of just feel better. And then I can come back home and do like the stuff I need to do. Knowing how to relax and how to be social enough is I'm only by myself. I kind of just like spiral on myself or get a little too anxious or like negative or weird or whatever. But like getting a little social interaction and then coming back and doing stuff I need to do alone is very helpful for me.
Solitude versus like isolation is a tough needle to thread, I think. And that meme of like the two guys on the bus and one's facing the mountainside and he's sad and one's facing like the sunset and he's happy. And it's like the sad guy is feeling alone and the happy guy is being alone. And so it's sort of like that. You know, it's like if you feel lonely, if you feel disconnected from people, then that sucks. But also if you feel overwhelmed with people and there's just always someone in your business, then that is equally hard, you know? As New Yorkers, we encounter both of those things quite a lot. Cause like fucking, like we're never within, you know, we're never like away from people really like geographically necessarily, but we can like find a space where we can sort of sit by ourselves and sort of tune people out for a minute and just like vibe with ourselves. And that's important. Cause I don't know if you've ever lived in like a crappy, like five roommate apartment where like you don't get a fucking second to just like go like make some food by yourself without somebody lumbering through the living room or somebody's watching Always Sunny in Philadelphia or some shit. Like it's just like, God damn, leave me alone. I don't want to talk to anyone right now.
Yeah. I live a pretty privileged life. But yeah, I was, I had an apartment in New York that was kind of crappy, but it was just me and one roommate and it was fine. Now I live with my wife in Astoria, and we have a two bedroom for the two of us. So I have an office where I'm recording this now.
Nice.
And yeah, I get a decent amount of long time. I inherited a car from my wife's uncle, who he didn't die, but he just like moved to Florida, gave me his car. So I'm not living that like exact same New York life that maybe I was a few years ago, because I'm out in Astoria, so I can kind of drive places. I can take the subway. I can be in New York, that New York life, but I don't have to be, which is nice.
Do you struggle with imposter syndrome?
I don't, honestly. I know maybe you should say you do, but no, I really don't. I'm me, yeah. I mean, who am I an imposter for? I'm too weird to be like anybody else, yeah. Yeah, I'm authentic. I mean, in general, I mean, I guess maybe some class-based ones, because I'm pretty leftist, but it's like I'm living a pretty solid middle-class life.
Yeah, I guess, but... You don't have to be poor to be a lefty. In fact, the idea of leftism is that everybody should be living a comfortable life and have their material needs met, and you know, even be able to like a little bit of zhuzh, a little vacation, a little bread and roses.
Oh yeah, absolutely, yeah.
You know.
Class based stuff. Yeah, I mean, in general, yeah, I mean, I know I'm funny, yeah. I mean, if anything, yeah. And stand-up comedy also in New York treats you so badly that it would be hard to get imposter syndrome. So it's like, oh, I'm not good, you know, I'm not good enough to do this unpaid spot. Like, I'm definitely good enough to do comedy for free for you. Like, yeah. So you want to, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. So it's like, yeah, like I'm not treated well enough to get it. Sometimes when you're about to go, like, do a long set on the road, I used to feel like that. And then I would just be like, Fred, everyone here but you knows you can do this. So you should just know it.
Mm.
So, and I've gotten past that. Also doing longer sets recently has got me. If I had to do an hour or longer than an hour, and like there was a certain expectation, like you must crush, then maybe I would start feeling it. But like you have to be given stuff to feel like an imposter. So if everything's kind of, you have to really work. If you have to kind of like grind and beg and whatever for everything, then you're not going to feel like an imposter.
You have to have stuff in order to feel like you don't deserve it.
Yeah, I more just feel like, why the hell do they? Because the way New York comedy works is either you're cool or you don't exist. And like, I don't exist. So like, I'm more like, why don't, you know, like that sucks. Like just resentful. Yeah, I'm more resentful. I more feel it for other people than for me.
Mm. Do you?
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Like you'll see a comic get something who you don't think is funny, and you're like, they must have a really good manager.
Yeah,
Shit like that. Like that's more. Yeah, like I'm more about that. Yeah.
There definitely is. I mean, so on that note, do you fall into like a lot of like compare and despair, and you have to like pull yourself back from like,
oh, constantly,
jealousy,
yeah,
envy, and you know, I mean, there are good and bad things I think about like being a hater and being a shit talker. I think to some degree, I think that's a totally normal human thing to do, but like, I think there is a point where to which like it consumes people, and that's all they are is just this like.
Yeah, I'll give you one today. An article came out in Variety today, mm-hmm, about stand up comics in New York, and most of the article was about ones who talk about Palestine. Obviously, I wasn't included, or was in Vulture. I'm sorry, Vulture, which is cooler.
Yeah,
but now why didn't they include me? Well, they have no idea who I am. Because the only people they know people who are above a certain level or have managers or whatever. So yeah, it's not that they hate me, they just don't have no idea who I am. Yeah. But yeah, I'm a comic who's lost stuff talking about Palestine, but I'm not important enough to be considered for an article about comics like that in my own city.
Right. So do you on that same note, like do you struggle with perfectionism? Do you hold yourself to like a high standard that you can't meet, or are you able to kind of like roll with the punches and flaws and
high standard that I can't meet? Definitely overpromise. Yeah, I've been working on one man show that I've been telling people about. Now I still have to write the full script, and I have been putting that off for a few months. I've been focusing on touring. Yeah, right. It's impossible. The amount of things I want to do, I have ideas for a history podcast I want to do. There's a million things I want to do. Getting the energy or the bandwidth to do it, it's, yeah, I can't meet my own standards for sure. I have high standards for myself, yeah, and can't meet them.
It can be really hard. I mean, if you are an ambitious person and you have a lot of ideas, it's almost impossible to do the amount of things that you want to, you know, actually do. Like, there really only are, you know, so many hours in the day, despite what that like inane fucking mug that says, you know, Beyonce has as many hours of the day as you do, or whatever the fuck. Like it's actually quite a bit harder for normal people to get all of those things done.
Oh yeah, there's delegating or whatever.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, what it Beyonce, somebody listens to this. Beyonce is very overrated. She's very, very talented. She's an incredibly talented pop star who makes content that will not be remembered.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, she's just talented and great looking, and that's it. She has the most sizzle of anyone, but very little stake. As far as like, she's not talking about anything. It's just corporate R&B or whatever. It also, yeah, it's just, it's, she's not special. She is an art, there's not very little artistic value to it. Even her movie, she has a concert movie coming out. The trailer was like, I want to make a night where women can like feel special and like everyone can feel like amazing. And it's like, these tickets cost $1,000, Beyonce. Like, it's, you're only doing that for like rich people.
Yeah. Yeah. It bugs me when people get to like a certain level of, status, I guess. The Beyoncés and Taylor Swifts of the world, where people treat them like they're these like modern gods. And I'm like, they're fine. I guess it's cool if you like their music, but I feel like you're getting a little too excited about this.
Yeah. Also, yeah, Beyonce married to Jay-Z. Jay-Z sucks. I love his music. I'm a huge Jay-Z fan of his music. Black capitalism, the idea that black people will get saved by building their own capitalism, like that's been disproven a long time ago. That's a terrible vision, building a parallel capitalism. And it's not what we need to be thinking. We need to be all uniting and working together like on class-based stuff. And still caring about race and racial issues, but definitely not forming our own parallel capitalisms.
Tell me a little bit about your one-man show.
It's about the history of Jesus. I'm still writing the script, so I hope it eventually comes out. I mean, like, I'm worried now. I'm like, what? I haven't been writing the play. I'm like, if I die, because I was reading about Karl Marx, and if he dies, when he died, Engels had to spend 10 years putting together the last two volumes of Capital.
Right.
It took 10 years to read Marx's handwriting is the joke I'm working on. But because I have messy handwriting. So if I die, someone else has to put the show together, I guess. I don't really know if anyone would. But it's about the history of Jesus. And basically, when you read the mainstream historian view, he's just an insane person. He's just a weirdo who thought the world was ending. And then I was writing about that, and I thought it was pretty funny. And I read a lot about Christianity and all this stuff. And then my director coach for the show was saying, why do you care? And I realized I care because of my dad. My dad's also a crazy person. So my dad is like Jesus, but that's not a compliment to either of them. Then I was writing it in the spring of last year. My dad did have cancer, but I mean, he could have lived another 5 years, whatever. You know, anything was possible at that point. You know, there's ups and downs in the health process. So then my dad died while I was writing the show. So my dad died for the sake of the show, and that made him more like Jesus, I guess.
Yeah.
So then a lot of the show is about my dad and my dad dying, but the parallel, it's not another dead dad show. It's about like learning about that. And also like someone's dead and you love them, but like they're still pretty crappy in a lot of ways. So it's kind of about all that stuff.
I mean, now you got a whole meta layer, you know, you were writing about your dad and then he dies and then you have to deal with that on top of that. Like you got oodles of raw content there. And I think it's just a matter of refining it into something.
Yeah. I've written a lot, and it just needs to be refined into a script. And then I was gonna take a pass at it in like January, and then it didn't happen. And then I started booking tours and stuff because I did a tour in February where I actually made money. And if I could do more like that, then maybe I don't have to like go back to tutoring or whatever. And I'm really trying to make it all happen. And I know I finally believe that I have the headlining set worthy of headlining. So I'm ready to go. I'm actually ready to go out there and do it. I'm trying to book more stuff. But then it's just how many things can you do? I mean, you're doing stand up. You want to make online content. You want to write the one man show. You want to tour. You want to maybe make some money. There's a million things. So it's like I'm just strained in a lot of directions, and I'm trying to get better at it, but it's tough.
It must be exciting though to like finally be like kind of turning a profit with comedy and finally getting to where like, oh, the idea of being like a professional comic is possible, is within reach, is maybe something that can happen for me. Like that's big.
It feels like it happened a year too late to be exciting, because if it happened a year earlier, I was making enough money tutoring, but now it's happening and I'm trying to get it going while I don't have enough money coming in.
Right.
And literally what happened was I was doing great with money, and then my dad died. I didn't work in the summer, and I like started using a little savings, and then the firing. So basically I was great with money until my dad died, and now it's like, it's just stress. I guess this is a part of what stresses you, so I'm talking about it a lot normally when complain, but yeah. But yeah,
financial stress is fucking real, man. It's like I've said this before. All I talk to my therapist about anymore, or all I talk about with my therapist anymore, is money. It's just money. It's just like, how am I going to get a decent job? How am I going to fucking figure this out? How am I going to get out of fucking credit card debt? What am I going to do about my student loans? I don't even want to think about those right now. You know, like, it's just that. And I think it's really the kind of comforting thing is that it feels like a lot of people are in that position of financial precarity. So, like, I'm not alone. I'm not purely a fuck up. But also, It can also be disturbing that the problem is that widespread and it's this big economic force that I have very little control over and feels insurmountable too. So, you know, it can be a little bit of both. So I guess it's all in how you look at it.
I know I have it better than other people because my rate of money coming in is not good, but I still have savings for a bit longer. So I'm not in. That's also why I don't want to be an impossible. I don't want to pretend like I'm living paycheck to paycheck when I'm not yet doing that.
We should wrap up, but this has been really lovely. Let's talk about plugs. Anything you'd like to plug coming up, and where people can find you, and hopefully one day see your one man show about Jesus and your dad.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I'm hoping. Yeah, it's at Orange Freddy G on all the social medias, including YouTube. Always posting stuff there. I will be touring more. I know I'm going to in early April. I'm going to be headlining a couple shows in Richmond, and then I'm headlining Bethlehem Steel Stacks in May, and other things I'm throwing on the calendar. So yeah, if you live in the East Coast of America, I'll hopefully be headlining somewhere near you, and then I am working on Midwest in the fall, maybe Canada or stuff like that. Definitely just following me and then just like respond, like enjoying the content there and maybe like buying tickets or something like that from there.
Hell yeah, brother. Well, thanks for being on the show, and good luck writing your magnum opus.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Thank you once again to Freddie G for being on the show. Cool guy, really smart guy. I kind of think just talking to him for a while, he's got one of them computer brains. He's got one of them brains that, like, he reads a sentence once and it's just in there. It's just in his fucking head. And he can just recall things, like a photographic sort of memory, like one of those guys. I get the feeling. I haven't confirmed it, but he just has that vibe to me. Anyway. Hope you enjoyed that. Check out his stuff. And remember your homework. Eat your vegetables. Squash your beef. Do your stuff. You don't have to fix all your problems. Just pick one. Pick one this week and take care of it. One thing you've been meaning to... Ugh. I don't want to have to fucking... there's this guy. And then I've got to fucking... I know. It's way easier to just not. But... trust me, you will do it, and it will feel better. Unless it doesn't. Unless it just really fucks things up even more. And it just really, just opens a floodgate of terrible. But, hey, you tried. I don't know. You tried. And honestly, even if it goes bad, that feels better than... just letting it sit. Don't let it sit. Fuck it. Burn a bridge. Have a blowout fight with your family at the dinner table. Just burn it all down. Ruin everything. Do that this week. That's what I'm telling you. Okay, follow me at Bradical Pearson, Instagram and Twitter. I don't really tweet anymore. Blue Sky, whatever. I don't give a shit. You're listening to the show, and that's what matters to me the most. Follow the show at SelfWorst on Instagram. I post fun content on there. Follow me on patreon.com/selfworst. Subscribe for as little as $1 a month. And look at this. I am actually making fucking content now. I made good. I'm doing it. I'm really doing it this time, baby. I've changed. I've changed. Please take me back. I made a video last week about how to build a shelf. Making another video this week about how to install some stuff in drywall, drywall anchors, and how to deal with having a crappy wall where you can't find a stud and you got to install something heavy on there. So I'm going to walk you through that. That's coming up this week. You get a little handyman advice from your boy. We're going to do all kinds of stuff on there and tell you about all kinds of secrets. Secrets of doing shit. Doing shit that I figured out. All right. That's all. Have a good week. I'm Brad Pearson, and I'll never forget you.